We got a really practical section tonight. Once again, the book of Ecclesiastes. If this one doesn't hit you between the horns every week, then I don't know what will. We always like to have an opportunity to get in fellowship with the Lord. So, are there any other prayer requests before we go in? And 1 John 1:9 and that kind of thing. Okay, so. Yeah, all my family, that's just a disaster, so you can pray for them. So I'm pretty much mom, dad, and 5 kids right now. So I pretty much have to do everything, and I don't know how to do laundry, so I got to learn tonight. I didn't know how to do it in college either. That's why I married her. But, I'm like cooking, everything. So, and doing this too, studying, what? And homeschooling, what? Oh, the flu. They have the flu. Well, some of them are well, but they still can't. They're pretty well, but they still can't touch anything. Me and Emma haven't got it. We're the only ones. We're the last survivors. But everybody, it's bad. Don't get it if you can help it. It's really not good. Okay, so another really practical section, and let's start with the opportunity to get in fellowship with the Lord, and then we'll just have a word of prayer and deal with another really interesting section. My goodness. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the opportunity to be here and to look once more at this book that you wrote through Solomon and his reflections when he started to live his life as if you weren't there, as if you didn't exist, and try to explore by observation and experimentation every area of life and try to be satisfied and to ultimately find that there's nothing there, that there's no grass on the other side of the fence. It's certainly not greener. And to appreciate that he realized this, he came back at the end of his life and walked with you once more, although it certainly was a great loss to have spent so much time living life as if you weren't there. And so help us to learn how to live through this, through his eyes, how to reject living by the flesh and live by the Spirit so we can enjoy life to its fullest and have true satisfaction, which is centered ultimately on you and having a relationship with you. And not just a relationship, but fellowship, walking with you daily. So we pray for that as a end goal of this book in our own lives, for our own application. And thank you that you've given it to us. And bless our time together. Be with those who are unable to be with us, like Les Murdoch and Phyllis. Be with them and help Dana continue to get better, and this little girl and her family as they work through those things. Of course, all the other problems, Evelyn and her ankle and so forth. There's so many issues that we all face, and some we know about, some we don't know about, but we thank you that you know about them all and are attending to their needs. And we just ask that we have a wonderful time tonight, enjoying your word, fellowshipping amongst one another, and we ask all these things in Jesus' precious name. Amen. Okay, so we are into the third section of the book of Ecclesiastes, and last week we started that section, which began in chapter 6, where Solomon wanted to make some further observations. And of course, what he's showing thematically in each section is the same basic thing, that, you know, life is vanity when we try to live life as if God isn't there. And that's something that we all have a tendency to do. We get involved in our own circumstances, our own life, our own community or families and so forth, and we can forget about him and just go on like he doesn't exist. And we want to detract away from, we want to pull away from that kind of thinking. And in chapter 6, what Solomon's trying to do is look out at people and see how they're living in the world, how they're facing the issues they're facing, and you know, watch those responses. And he's come back to us with a report. And so we're going to kind of review some of the things here in chapter 6 and then go into chapter 7. So the issue here in chapter 6 is, well, there's two issues. that he found to be very troublesome for people that live with as if God's not there. One is wealth, and the other is someone who has a tremendous blessing. So you may say that, well, those are one and the same, but they're not in Jewish thought. You could be really wealthy financially, but not have the kind of blessing that's viewed here. So really, these are two issues for them. And in verse 1, he's saying, you know, I've seen that there's this great misfortune that is experienced by people who live without God. This is a great burden that weighs on them. I mean, they don't know how to deal with this. And that is verse 2, that God is going to give some person a great amount of wealth, but then he's not going to let him enjoy that wealth. And instead, even worse than that is well, somebody else gets to enjoy the wealth. So how is this? Why does God do such a thing? Well, basically, the reason seems to be because the person whom God gave the wealth will not give thanks to God for the wealth. The fallacy and what people think is that wealth will intrinsically make me happy. It has a quality to it that it can give me enjoyment and satisfaction. And what Solomon is doing here is tearing that idea apart. He's saying, not only does a person not become wealthy on their own, but God gives it to them, but more than that, the enjoyment of it is also from him, and it can't be had without him. So if there is any enjoyment of it, I don't care if it's a believer or unbeliever, that's irrelevant. If there's any enjoyment of it, it's because God's given that person the enjoyment of it. Okay? But wealth itself is not a source of satisfaction. It doesn't have that ability. And the reason it doesn't is because man has an infinite eternity, as Solomon says, set in his heart. And that means there's this infinite chasm in us that can be only filled by someone who's infinite. And wealth, of course, isn't infinite. So it can never truly satisfy. In order then to enjoy wealth in the greatest way, the only way to do that is to put God, the giver of wealth, at the center of the wealth, give him thanks for it, and so forth, and then we can enjoy it. And then in verses 3 to 6, he's hypothesizing. That's something he saw, but here he's just hypothesizing about a similar misfortune, but different in Jewish thought. And this one's also a great burden. In this one, there's a man. He has great blessing in terms of Jewish culture, meaning here that he had, it says, 100 children, which is hyperbole. Of course, that's a lot of children. And many years of life. He lives a long life. And yet, it says he doesn't get to enjoy any of this. He doesn't get to enjoy any of the blessing. And at the end of verse 3, Solomon says, well, it'd just be better to be a miscarriage than to be this man. And his reasoning is there in verse 4, because at least the miscarriage never came into this world. And you know, if you never come into this world, you never know all the troubles of this world. You don't know all the miseries. You don't know all the frustrations. You don't know all the stresses. You don't have any of that if you're a miscarriage, right? And further, he says, and it was never known, you know, in the sense of being named or anything. And in verse 5, the miscarriage never even saw the light of the sun. And even more so in verse 6, I mean, look at this. Even if the man that had this great blessing lived to be 1,000 years twice, 2,000 years old, see, if he doesn't enjoy good things, in the end, you know, all go to the grave. He and the miscarriage end up in the exact same place, right? So it's better to be the miscarriage because, at least as the miscarriage, you didn't have to see 2,000 years worth of sorrows. You know, you had no sorrows. And so then in verses 7 to 12, Solomon just gives us 10 proverbial lessons, and we'll just review these. First, all a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. Now, the lesson is just that temporal and material things will just never satisfy you. And the only two things that will ultimately satisfy you are the opposites. Not something that's temporal, but something that's eternal. Not something that's material, but something that's spiritual. That answers to eternity in our heart, set in our hearts. And second, verse 8a, for what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? And the lesson here is that, you know, you can pursue the intellectual, academia, all that stuff, but it's never going to satisfy you. You ultimately go to the same place, you know, the fool goes to. The only kind of intellectual pursuit that actually gives you an advantage is the pursuit of God and the knowledge of God. And third, Verse 8b, the third lesson, what advantage does the poor man have knowing how to walk before the living? And the lesson here is you know, your life does not consist of what you possess. Too many people make that mistake. You are defined by what you possess. That is how other people view you. Or you think people view you that way. But in God, that really is irrelevant. It's how God views you that matters. And God doesn't look at the outside, right? He looks at the heart. The fourth lesson he gave us, verse 9, what the eyes see is better than what the soul desire. We all know this. Here it is. It's better to be content with what you have than to always be wanting something more. Okay. Fifth, verse 10a, whatever exists has already been named. That is to say, the circumstances you find yourself in throughout your 70 or 80 or 90 years, whatever they are, the circumstances you find yourself in, those are decided by God. They're already decided by God. You're going to find yourself in those circumstances. How you respond to that, as he'll teach again tonight, that's what will determine your quality of life in your circumstances. That's what will determine your quality of life. Sixth lesson, verse 10b, middle of 10, and it's known what man is. In other words, we know who man is. Man is a fallen creature. He's just bringing it up saying, remember this. Don't forget this. Don't forget that we're fallen creatures. Okay? And seventh, verse 10c, for he cannot dispute with him who is stronger than he is. In other words, the creature cannot contend or dispute with the creator. Oh, we can't do that. I mean, that's you can't do it. You're just not in a position. You're finite. He's infinite. He's strong. We're weak. Eighth, verse 11. For there are many words which increase futility. What then is the advantage to a man? In other words, what advantage are you going to get for arguing with God about the way your life is? Okay, what are you going to? You're not going to change it. You're not going to change it. Okay. It's not going to change anything. You're just wasting your time, you know, arguing with him about what happened in your life. Ninth, verse 12a, for who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime? See, the lesson here is you don't know what is good for you. It's a funny lesson. You don't know what's good for you. It's what our parents told us. That's why I'm laughing. I feel like I'm a kid again when I say that. And in this context, we are his children, right? And we say, you don't know what's good for you, you know, but we're assuming we know. And in this context, he does know. But see, we can't see where it's all going here. Just like Joseph couldn't see where all the things that took place in his life in the book of Genesis, he could not see that where it was all going. It's just that constant trust that God is working everything together for good. So, that's the ninth lesson. Now, the tenth lesson is verse 12b, for who can tell a man, this is just the explanation, who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? You just can't know the future, see? And when you put all these ten lessons together as a Christian, you know, and you're going through the certain circumstances that he determined, and you're saying, why'd you give me this lot? You know, and you want to get mad at God, and you want to question his plan for your life, and all of that, the important thing to do is start stringing together the doctrines that we know. And here's what we know, okay? Not only from here, but from other passages, we know. You know, I don't know what's going on with my life, and I can't see where it's all going. And I can't see what in the world good could come out of this. But I do know the one who has a plan for my life. And I do know that God is benevolent, that he's a good God. And that he has a plan and purpose for my life, including all the troubles and all the difficulties that I'm having in this fallen world. And I know that ultimately, somehow, this is all working together for good. I just can't see it. Okay? But he's not going to let you see it either. See, that's the whole thing. Not now, at least. Yeah, maybe later, but like Joseph, he saw at the end, right? But so maybe later, but he's just not going to show it to you. You have to trust. That's how he wants us to live, to walk by faith. So chapter 6 gives us several lessons about, you know, how am I going to have satisfaction when I live in this fallen world that's just, it's just riddled by troubles. I mean, left and right. I mean, we're living them right now, or I am, at the house. And it's like this, you know, here and there, back and forth, you know. So we come today to Ecclesiastes 7. And Boy, I'm glad I had this to study this week when I could squeeze in a few moments, because it's helping. And the key to chapter 7 is not verse 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's all the way down to verse 14. So we're going to start with verse 14 and backtrack, because if we don't, verse 1 and all the others are going to be really difficult to follow. Why he's saying what he's saying, okay? So let's just go to where he brings it all together at the end, verse 14. And you'll see from verse 14 that the topic is prosperity and it's adversity, okay? And more than that, it's how God is the author of both of these. And why that is in our lives and how we should respond to that or in these circumstances. So in verse 14, let's just read it. In the day of prosperity, be happy, but in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so the man will not discover anything that will be after him. So he's saying, there's two basic circumstances we find ourselves in. Prosperity and adversity. And it's very important to understand that God's the author of both. Right? And the reason is so that we can't predict. This is what's so interesting at the end of the verse. The reason is so we can't predict the future of our lives. God doesn't want our lives to be predictable. Why? Well, if our lives were predictable, we could know what was coming. We could live by sight. We wouldn't have to live by faith. We'd know what was coming. We could already see it, right? But that's not living by faith. And that would mean we'd go about trying to live life without God. But see, God doesn't want us to try to live life without Him. He wants us to trust Him moment by moment. Now, as far as our response to prosperity there in verse 14, Solomon says, how should we respond to the day of prosperity? You know, be happy. Enjoy it, right? And then as far as our response to adversity, he says, consider. And that's a thought term. He's saying, be thoughtful. I want you to think when you have adversity. Okay? And so both of these are actually for our own good. You know, the prosperity and the adversity. And he's put them both in our lives, and the reason he's done so is to improve us. But the key to that improvement is, how do we respond? How do we respond to our circumstances? How do we respond to prosperity? How do we respond to adversity? Most of us say, well, I won't have much of a problem responding to prosperity by being happy. But most of us really have trouble saying, I respond to adversity by being very thoughtful about the fact that God has placed this in my life for a specific purpose, and I'm going to think about that and, you know, be thankful. Glenn in the Bible Knowledge Commentary summed up this section saying, the key to this section is found in verse 14a, where Solomon declared that God is the author of both adversity and prosperity, and that he so mingles them together that man in his finite understanding cannot discover anything about his future. The ramifications of this for Solomon were that adversity might have positive benefits. I mean, adversity might be good for you. And prosperity might have ill effects. It might be bad for you. But the effects of either depend on how one responds to them. Okay? Whether wisely or foolishly. So our response, of course, becomes important. Now, another thing, just before we get into the verses, is another observation, is that if you just kind of scan the verses, you'll see that there's a word used over and over and over, a certain adjective, the word better. So let's do verse 1. A good name is better than good ointment. Verse 2, it's better to go to a house of mourning than a house of feasting. We could do some other. Verse 5, skip down to verse 5. It is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the praise of fools. Okay, and so forth and so on. Okay, over eight times, Solomon says it is better, trying to tell us that, you know, one situation you'll find yourself in life is preferred over, or should be preferred over another. And sometimes it's prosperity that should be, you know, preferred over adversity, like in verses 11 and 12 there. But at other times, adversity is to be preferred over prosperity, like in verses 1 through 5 or 6 there. Okay? But he sees both of them as coming from the hand of God, and he sees both of them as for our ultimate good. Okay? and the goal of which is to get us to respond properly to prosperity and to adversity. And what is the proper response? Again, prosperity, you'd be happy. Adversity, be thoughtful. Okay? The last observation before we start is that you'll see that these are kind of like proverbs. We kind of started that a little bit in chapter 6. And a proverb is just sort of a short, pithy way of capturing a truth. And so here we have some proverbs, and that means that clearly we have more proverbs than what's included in the book of Proverbs, right? And First Kings tells us that he wrote, 3,000 proverbs or something like that. So, and all of those weren't captured. So, but here some more are in addition to all that are in the book of Proverbs, which is really chapter 9, till the end in the book of Proverbs. So in verse 1, let's look at the first proverb, okay? A good name is better than a good ointment, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. It's just, honestly, that's hard to understand. it's hard for me to understand. I had to take quite a bit of time on this one. But basically, what Solomon is saying is that if one dies, okay, with a good name, meaning a good reputation, then that's a better day than the day of his birth, because on the day of your birth, there's only the promise that you will go through life and gain a good reputation, okay, by the end of your life. But the guy who dies with a good reputation, see, he's already attained that, so it's better. That's a better day. So, and it's poetic. There's a play on words, and there's a chiasm. And so what all this means is that really everything in verse 1 goes together. It's not two separate things, okay? They're tied up together. So let's just sort of break it down. He says a good name is better than good ointment. I already said a good name. Your name is your reputation. You hear some names around here, and everybody goes, oh, gosh, or, oh, yeah. What are you seeing? You're seeing the reflection of a reputation that a family has, right? So a good name is a good reputation. And how do you develop a good reputation? Well, you live a wise life. You live well, okay? And that is seen by others and respected. Now he says, this is better than good ointment. What's this? Well, good ointment is actually what the Jewish mothers would place or, put on the baby, okay, when it was born. It was their way of, giving the baby a good start on life. Being a good mother, and giving the baby the best opportunity it can have. But you see, since putting ointment on the baby cannot ensure that that child is going to grow up and live a wise life and gain a good reputation with men, see, then that day is not as good as the day that you die with a good reputation before men. See? And so, we come to the second portion of the verse, which again, like I'm saying, is tied in with it. He says, so the day of one's death better than the day of one's birth. And because, see, the day of one's death, if he has that good reputation, if he has that good name, it's etched in stone on that day. And because he had a good reputation, it's better than the day of that man's birth. So it's quite clear why, then, you can see that the day of his death is better than the day of his birth, okay? Because you get that ointment rubbed on you by mama, right when you come out of the womb, and that's wonderful and all. It gives you this good start, but it doesn't ensure you're going to have a good finish, does it? But the guy who makes it to the end and finishes well and has that good reputation, see, that is going to have a continuing influence forever. See, Ryrie said, the day of death is better if one has made a good name for himself during life so that his life has a continuing influence. And that's the big idea. You want your reputation to go down, sort of in the hall of fame, so to speak, so people think well of you, speak well of you in your absence, when you're already gone. Okay? Okay, so in verse 2, he gives another proverb. Okay? Now, by the way, I forgot to say this. Now, the only way to really have a good name, a good reputation by the end of your life, in this context, is to respond properly to adversity and to respond properly to prosperity. See, if you make a wrong response to either one of those, what it's going to do is it's going to damage your reputation, right? So if you have the right responses to these through life, that's what builds that good reputation. You're recognizing God placed these problems and also these solutions in my life, and there's a purpose to them. And that's why I'm responding the way I do. That's why I have the reputation I do. Okay, verse 2, another proverb. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that's the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. I don't know how many times I've used this in a funeral, right? In the sense in which Solomon intended it. The house of mourning, of course, is the funeral, right? The house of feasting is going to a party, okay? Now, it's better... Not many people would say, I love going to funerals. I can't stand parties. Not many people would say that. No, but Solomon said that, see? So what did Solomon see? Well, Wiersbe said this. Given the choice, you know, most people would rather go to a birthday party than a funeral. But Solomon advised against it. Why? Because sorrow can do more good for the heart than laughter can. That's what Solomon means at the end of the verse where he says, and the living takes it to heart. That is, those who are living at the funeral, you know, that what does it mean, take it to heart? It means they think about it. The heart is the thinking center of man. It means they really think about the shortness of their life. They think about the brevity. They think about the lives of other people that they're closely connected with and how they might be impacting them by their responses to them. You know, when you go to those, you know, funerals, in many cases, you're forced to think that the number of days, it may not be many. And remember, you know, the grave, by the way, is just like inches below your feet, you know, all the time. It's good to think about that, okay? It makes us more appreciative of the people around. It makes us more compassionate toward them. It makes us more loving and more thoughtful and more giving. In Psalm 90, Moses said this, right? Psalm 90, verse 12, so teach us to number our days. You know, be thoughtful. How many days you got, you know? Why? That we may present to God a heart of wisdom. See? I mean, because if we're not numbering our days, we're just acting like we've got all these days left or whatever. We're just messing around. We're not developing a heart of wisdom to present to God. So, you know, somebody who chooses, well, no, I'm going to the party, I'm not going to a funeral. See, they're not even really interested in developing a heart of wisdom toward God. Okay, but the big point is that adversity in this case, the adverse situation being going to a funeral, right, is better than a prosperity situation, you know, going to a party, okay? Because only the adverse situation, only the funeral can develop within us wisdom. See, prosperity can't do that. Going to a party cannot do that, okay? Now, at the same time, by the way, it doesn't mean any good can't come out of a party. Solomon's not saying that, okay? Because going to a party could give you some existential happiness, you know, some momentary happiness or whatever. But see, what a party can never do is produce wisdom. Sorry. So the adversity is better than the prosperity. Now in verse 3 we see a similar proverb that few would dare utter. You know, I just don't see anybody saying this. Sorrow is better than laughter. I've never heard anybody say that. And then he says, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. We'll talk about that. But note the word better again there. Sorrow is better than laughter. Over and over, Solomon's going to say one thing's better than another. They're comparisons of two things relative to one another, one being adverse and one being prosperous. So in this case, the adverse against sorrow is better than laughter. Why? Well, again, because sorrow can do more good for the heart than laughing can. Okay. Well, you say, well, what kind of good can sorrow produce? Well, the good reflection brings about wisdom in our lives. Okay. I mean, when we're laughing it up, we are not, you know, gaining wisdom by reflecting on life. We're just not doing that. We only do that when we're in sorrow. Again, it's not saying that laughing can't do anything for us. It's not saying that. Okay. I mean, Solomon said in Proverbs 17:22 that a joyful heart is good medicine, right? But sorrow does more for the heart because what it does is it provokes us to think, and that through that thinking produce wisdom in our lives. And the last part of this verse is a further explanation, or it's supposed to be, but frankly, the translation is more confusing than anything. For when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. In other words, you know, what it means in the English is real simple. I mean, a person can look sad on the outside, but they can be happy on the inside. I mean, I know what that means, but that's just not what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew says this, for in sadness of heart there is good for the heart. In sadness of heart there is good for the heart. And of course that means something different. That means that when we go through something that's sorrowful, it's good for our thinking. It's good for us because it produces wisdom in us. Okay, so I was getting the PowerPoint ready, and I was sitting there going through this, and I was like, "No, that's not verse 3. That's verse 4, right?" And I go look at the text, and I was like, "I forgot verse 4, so I have to, I'm sorry, I skipped verse 4." But that's just the way the week was. How did I miss verse 4? But I skipped a verse. I've never done that. But here, in verses 1 to 4, here's my summary. Solomon has shown us the advantages of adversity over prosperity, as in why the day of one's death could be better than the day of one's birth, or how going to a funeral is better than going to a party, or how going through something sorrowful is better than laughing. And the basic reason the adverse situation is better is because it makes us thoughtful and it develops wisdom in us. Okay. Okay, so let's move to verse 5. And here he continues to show us why, you know, adversity is better. It's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. Now, when it says the song of fools, it's actually talking about praise, like flattery. It's not talking about he's singing a song. But you can see where the word praise and song are connected. Praise or flattery and connected with song. And that's how it should be translated. To listen to the praise of fools. So the basic lesson, of course, is that it's better to get corrected than it is to get praise. How many people do you hear say that? I mean, I just love getting criticized or corrected, you know, rebuked, as the text says. I really prefer that over people flattering me, telling me how wonderful I am. No, nobody says these things, okay? Except Solomon. Solomon's saying these things. Most people don't. That's the last. The last thing they want today is somebody to rebuke them, to correct them. I mean, really? You think you're that smart? I'm the one that's that smart. You know, I mean, that it's just a bunch of arrogance, you know, when you respond that way to correction, of course. But that's the attitude of a fool, okay? It may be hurtful to be rebuked, but he's saying, look, it's better in that, you know, when you hear that from whoever said it, more than likely, it's a wise person here who said it. You probably need it, right? You probably need it, okay? Now, Wiersbe said it this way. He said, the rebuke is better because the rebuke of a wise man will accomplish far more in our lives than will the flattery of fools. And when we think about it, of course, we know that's true. We know that's true. In hindsight, we look back and we appreciate those words of rebuke when they came from wise people. We realize God sent that person into my life, not to flatter me, but to rebuke me so that I could improve. Okay, but the flattering praise of a fool, it can't do anything like that. It can't improve you. It's not going to improve you. Now, verse 6 kind of continues, and it's likening the flattering words of the fool to laughter, because the word, it uses laughter here, but it's talking about those flattering words. And it's describing them as just as useless, it says, as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot. Now remember, this is all Jewish, right? So the thorn bushes are what they would use, you know, for kindling to start a fire under a cooking pot. Just like we'll go out and pick up sticks or whatever and start a fire. And so they've got their thorn bushes here, and as they got them on fire, as they lit them, they start crackling, you know, and all that. But you know, they didn't last long. They burn out quickly, and then it's really no use, you know, heating the pot, you know. He says, so is the laughter of the fool, okay? Or the flattery of the fool. It's just useless. It doesn't do any good, okay? It doesn't do any good to, you know, put your kindling under there into the pot and think you're going to get a hot meal out of it. It ain't going to do no good. You got to get the fire going with big logs, right? It's useless to just put that kindling under there and let it burn out. In the same way, it's useless to just be flattered by fools. It doesn't help. And Solomon says, this too is futility. See? Futility. That's the word that we see over and over in the book of Ecclesiastes, usually translated vanity, here translated futility. But and it can have these translations, has several different meanings. Another meaning, though, and the one that's best here, is useless. I mean, it's just useless. You know, you can put all that kindling there and light it, but it goes out and it's useless. It did not make your pot hot. Okay, and the same thing is true for all that flattery from fools. It just is useless. Wallace said, in comparison to the sober reflection of the wise, the laughter of fools is morally useless. The burning of thorns, like the laughter of fools, makes a lot of noise, but it accomplishes nothing. Okay? Therefore, it's better to receive a rebuke from a wise man than to constantly be flattered by fools. Now we come to verses 7 to 10, and Solomon now gives us some warnings. Okay? Now, these are warnings to a man who's on the right track in life. Okay? They're pursuing wisdom. They're pursuing having that good reputation by the end of their life. Okay? But there's a danger for this man. There's a danger of becoming wise in one's own eyes and abandoning that lifestyle and searching for an easier way. I mean, there's got to be a shortcut. And if you do this, the warning is that you'll go the way of the fool. Okay. So the wise man may have learned that the right way through life is almost never the easiest. It's almost never the easiest path, okay? But if he's going to maintain his good reputation, he has to respond to these temptations to take shortcuts correctly. He has to resist those. He has to continually just trust the Lord, and trust the Lord will give a solution. That he's got to be patient. Okay, so verse 7. For oppression makes a wise man mad, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Now here's some options for him. I mean, he's a wise man. He already has a pretty good reputation in the community. You know, I've got this adverse situation here. Maybe I could solve that by taking a bribe or oppressing others. And that could be a really strong temptation, because it's an easy and quick solution to apparently a difficult problem. You see, but if a wise man falls into this temptation, his reputation is going to be destroyed. He'll become, a madman. He'll become mad, which is a word for a fool. He'll become a crazy lunatic. Accepting a bribe and oppressing others, that would destroy him. See, so bribery and oppression are to be resisted. It's a temptation, but it should be resisted. And instead, the man should say, this is an adverse situation that I'm in. Guess what? God is the author of this adversity. He's placed me in these circumstances. And if I just trust him, he'll provide the solution. And then I get to preserve my good reputation in the sight of God and man. See? So that's the right route. In verse 8, another temptation in adverse times that could lead a wise man to abandon that path of wisdom and exchanging it for a foolish path. He says, the end of a matter is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. Here again, see, you have some kind of trouble, some kind of adverse situation, and you're trying to solve it. And you know the principle that the end of it, you know, when it's all said and done and you're past the problem, you know that's better than the beginning, when the thing is just now on the front burner and just been thrown in your lap. Everybody knows that it's better when you get to the other end of a problem than when it's just confronting you. Now, because of that, there's a great temptation to just solve it as quickly as possible, no matter what, and no matter how. See? And that would mean solving it with pride, with haughtiness of spirit, right? Going around, you know, forcing your will on everybody else's will just to get to the end of it, so we can get past this thing. See? But if you look at an adverse situation that way, it's like, we've just got to get through this thing. No matter how, and no matter who gets hurt or whatever, you're not accepting adversity as being a part of the plan of God, are you? You're not saying, No, God has authored this circumstance in my life. And he wants me to be thoughtful about it and patient. Instead, no, you're just blazing saddles, forging right through it and hurting lots of people along the way. So it's not in wisdom to do that. And if you do that, you're going to destroy your reputation again. See, you're not going to go to the day of your death with a good reputation. You're going to go to the day of your death with the reputation of a fool. See? So you've got to learn to accept adversity as from the hand of God. And so he says, you know, have a patient spirit. You know, be patient. Trust God for a solution. It may take years. Be patient. That's not easy. I know, but that's what he says. Now in verse 9, Solomon speaks about those who are angry about adversity. You know, this is how they respond to it. I mean, the way it paints the picture is that they're always on the verge of blowing up. He says, do not be eager in your heart to be angry. I mean, that's the blow up, you know, person. I mean, they're just ready for something to go wrong so they can explode on you. He says, for anger resides in the bosom of fools. I mean, it's right there in their lap, right? Of course, when you have adversity in your life, it's very tempting to get angry, isn't it? I mean, you're frustrated. But if we get angry, see, what are we doing again? We're saying, we don't want to accept the idea that God is the one who gave us this adversity. We're not accepting that, see? It's just like Job's wife. She was happy to accept all the prosperity that God gave them. You know, the 10 children, the 3,000 camels, and 20,000 sheep, and whatever it all is there in Job 1. It's a description of immense wealth. We say a mansion, Ferrari. That's what we would say. That's what Job 1 would say if it was written in 2018. She's very happy to receive all that prosperity from God. But then the adversity, she wasn't quite ready to accept that as from God. What did Job say? Shall we accept good from God and not difficulty? That guy had it right. Just like God said, I mean, this guy walked with God. I mean, it's remarkable. But, you know, the fool won't say that. They'll take the good from God. But they don't want to, no. The rest of it, no. But see, that's foolish. That's not even living in reality. In reality, both of these things, good and adverse things, come from God. And both of them are for our own good. And if we don't accept the adversity from God, our anger is going to destroy our reputation again, see? Isn't it? I mean, I bet you can name 5 people in this community off the top of your hand who have blow-up personalities. Probably some of you name more. That will. Why do you think that? That is their reputation. Where? How'd they get their reputation? From you? No. They did it themselves, didn't they? By having that anger and showing it to everybody else. So it's not other people. It's not God that's the problem. Okay? It's our response to adversity that comes from God. That's the problem. We bring trouble on ourselves. In verse 10, then, Solomon says, you know, in your older years, as you face adverse situations, it can tempt you to just, you know, try to cope with that by, you know, almost like living in the past. But he says we shouldn't do that. He says, don't say, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you should ask about this. I mean, it may be tempting, you know, to long for what people call the good old days, when we think, you know, life was better and life was easier, but it really wasn't. Wiersbe had this great quote, which I'll probably memorize. He says, it has been said that the good old days are the combination of a bad memory and a good imagination. And often this is true. You see, but the truth of the matter is that we're living today. And there's a plan of God today. And we're supposed to live in the plan of God today. Not 30 years ago, not 60 years ago. We can't sit around and talk about the former days just to avoid the adversity we're having to face today. That is not accepting, once again, that's not accepting adversity today as part of the plan of God today. Okay, it's trying to avoid it with a very good, say, imagination and a very bad memory. You're just living in the past. You can't even live in the present. So it's not from wisdom, he says, that we try to live in the past. Wisdom is living in the present. You have to live in the present, or should. Now, Glenn summarized verses 7 to 10 this way. So just summarize verses 7 to 10. Oppression of others, impatience, angry, and living in the good old days are all actions and attitudes essentially contrary to the submissive attitude Solomon later implied in view of God's sovereignty, verse 13. Therefore, they are foolish and unwise. See, those ways of living and those actions, those attitudes, it all contradicts the sovereignty of God over your life, doesn't it? We don't like that. We don't like the sovereignty. We don't like that he set up our circumstances. We don't like the circumstances we're in. And frankly, we don't like him very much. Because he's the one that did all that. It's his fault, see? No, it's your fault, see? It's your fault. Because you ain't going to change that. You ain't going to change God. But the only thing you can do is change your response to God. That's all you can do. Change your response to God. So to do that, you got to believe that he's working all things together for good. You just have to. Okay, so far Solomon, we got more, but so far Solomon has given instruction in verses 1 to 6 about the advantages of adversity over prosperity. I mean, things people would never say. Hey man, let's go to a funeral. Forget these parties. You know, just off the wall stuff. But very, very important to think through. And in verses 7 to 10, some warnings to the wise man not to become a fool when he faces adversity. You know, not to try to get out of the hard things. Not, you know, to just deal with it and trust the Lord. And now in verses 11 to 13, he reveals advantages of prosperity over adversity. And summarizes the whole scope in verse 14. Making sure we realize, hey, but all this comes from God and serve a purpose in the plan of God. So, let's look at verse 11. Wisdom, along with an inheritance, is good, and an advantage to those who see the sun. Okay, those who see the sun, by the way, those are just the living, right? They see the sun. They see the sunrise. They see the sunset. They see the sun. It's the living. Those who are living. And now there's a debate whether this should be translated, wisdom along with inheritance is good. Kind of like, you know, it's good to have both of these together. Or whether it should be translated like this, wisdom... I should have put this up here. I don't think I did. Wisdom is better than an inheritance. Which is the way it should be. Because that word good, wisdom along with an inheritance is good. That word good is the same Hebrew word that we've seen over and over that's translated better. He's saying wisdom is better than an inheritance. Wisdom is better than an inheritance. Not wisdom with an inheritance. Of course, we'd all agree that's good. But wisdom is better than an inheritance in this life. Because let's say that you receive an inheritance, but you don't have wisdom. What are you going to do with the inheritance? Blow it. It'll ruin you. Probably ruin others too. Because you don't have wisdom to manage it. So see, wisdom is better than an inheritance in this life. It provides a person with an advantage, he says, while they are alive, see? Because whereas an inheritance, it could destroy them. Verse 12 is his explanation. For wisdom is a... And this is a strange... Another strange duck. For wisdom is a protection, just as money is protection. Now, the way the Hebrew says this is... It says... The word protection is not there. It's the word a shade. It says wisdom is a shade, or wisdom is in a shadow, or and it also says money is a shade, or money is in a shadow, is a shadow. And so they took from that the idea of protection, you know, in the shadow of something, you know, meaning in a place of protection, which is how they got that. And that may be. It may be saying that wisdom, like money, see, provides protection for the one who has it. And wisdom does serve a protection for us in this life. I think we'd all agree. And with it, because without it, we could destroy our life. And money, we would all agree, money can serve as a protection in our life too, right? But see, with it, but wisdom is better. It's superior, right? Because still, if we don't have wisdom, we may not be able to manage the rest of our life. And so he's really pointing up ultimately, though, here then, the supremacy of wisdom. And that's what he goes on to in verse 12, in the middle of verse 12. But the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of its possessors. He's saying that when you have this knowledge, you have an advantage. And the knowledge, of course, that is that wisdom preserves the lives of those who possess it. If you know that, that wisdom will preserve your life if you possess it, then you'll strive after wisdom. You'll want wisdom. You'll be striving for wisdom. And here, of course, we're talking about divine wisdom. At least we'll see that we are. Because, by the way, up to this point, he hasn't even mentioned the name of God in any of these verses. Verses 1 through 12 have no mention of God at all. It's just about adversity and prosperity and which is better and so forth. But there's been no grand explanation, no way of putting it all together. Now, I've woven it in all the way through because I took you to verse 14 first, right? But if you're just reading this at first, there's no explanation for why these things are better. There's no explanation that the good things and the bad things come from God alike in our lives. There's been nothing like that, not until now. Because in verse 13, he begins to give us the grand explanation how and why all these things are true. He says, consider the work of God, for who is able to straighten what he has bent? Okay, in other words, you know, think about your prosperity in your life. And think about your adversities in life. And then say this, that is the work of God. That's the work of God in your life. That is his plan for your life. You say, oh, I don't like that. I just want it to all be smooth sailing. Yeah, well, you'd be a fool, you know. You would. You'd be a fool. You wouldn't have any character. You'd be a flake. He says, who is able to straighten what he has bent? I like to, in other words, you know, who is able to change his plan for your life? Who's going to change it? You can't change that. Now, you can correct wrongs, right? You can make things right. You can try to relieve suffering, you know. But we can't change the circumstances that he has placed us in. We can't change that for our life. There's some things you can't change. You can't straighten what he has bent, see? What are you going to do? When in the ancient world, when they'd have a road that was really crooked, you know, it's not very smooth journey. You know, not very fun. So what they'd want to do, the engineers, the Roman engineers, what do what? Try to make that road straight and flatten it out, you know, move rocks and so forth. Make smooth passage, right? Your life, though, is not going to be straightened out by the Roman engineers. That's the point, see? It's not going to be straightened out by you either, see? He's got your life basically like a crooked road. That's the way it is. Tell me it isn't so. Some of you have been around here for a while. Tell me that isn't so. Okay, and tell me there's anything you can do about it, see? That you could actually straighten that road out and make your life like smooth sailing all the way. You can't do that. Nobody can do that. Now, he wants us to think about this. that's why he's made our lives the way he's made them. Okay, he wants us to think about it. In verse 14, the grand conclusion. See, this should be our response. In the day when I'm prosperous, what am I going to do? What are you going to do? You're going to be happy. You're going to have to, okay? Because guess what? In the day of adversity, you're going to have some of those too, see? Consider, you know what I mean? Think. Think about it, see? Think, you know, God has made the day of prosperity, and God has made the day of adversity for me. And why did he do that? So that I won't be able to discover anything that's going to be in my future, see? Anything that's going to come after. So there's our two responses. You're going to have days of prosperity, be happy. You're going to have days of adversity, be thoughtful. Think deeply about, you know, what is God trying to work into my life? What is he trying to develop in my character? Okay? Again, this is not too far removed from what we do with our own children when we have our children, right? We're trying to instill something into them. We're trying to build character into them. And sometimes they have to go, it's a really crooked path for these kids, right, to get there, just like it was for us as kids. But it's the same way when, as we're adults, just in the plan of God, looking at it that way. He's the Father, and he says, I've got this really crooked path I have to have you go down. And the reason is because I'm trying to instill in something. I'm trying to make you into something, okay? So the bottom line is that God has made the day of prosperity. He's made both that day and the day of adversity. And the purpose is laid out right there at the end so that we will not discover anything that will come after us. In other words, so you just can't tell where your life is going. If we've learned one thing in the book of Ecclesiastes over and over, it's like, don't count your chickens until they hatched. I don't care if you have millions of chickens in the bank. Don't count them until they hatched, okay? Because more than likely, they're not going to be there when you die. A lot of them are not going to be there, okay? You just cannot know what's going to happen in the future, okay? And if we could tell the future based on... yeah, we don't want to do. We don't want to know, right? It would scare us to death, that's true. If we had a record where we could look at our past and we could look at where we are in the present and we could sketch where we're going to be in the future, again, we wouldn't have to live by faith. We could just live by sight. But that's not how God wants us to walk. He wants us to walk in day-to-day dependence on Him. Respond accordingly to Him. Be happy when we got a good, prosperous day. Be thoughtful when it's a day of adversity. Why are you doing this to me? What do you want to build in my life? I'm receptive to that. What? How do you want to change me? And see, if we're able to accept this and live this way, see, then verse 1 will become true. Then verse 1 will be everything, see? Because the day you die, what will be etched on your tombstone? Is it a good name? Is it a good reputation that has continuing influence? Or are you just a fool, see? Or are you just a fool? All right, in conclusion then, what can we learn? I'll just put down three things. Look, first of all, you know, God is sovereign over the circumstances of our lives. We don't control our circumstances. God has set those up for a specific purpose. The second thing is, you know, we are responsible to respond to the circumstances in the proper way. We see, this is something we can control. We can't control the circumstances, point one, but we can control how we respond to them. Okay? And we can go positive or we can go negative. And if we go positive, that's for our good. It will develop wisdom and result in a good reputation in our life for ourselves. If we respond negatively, well, it'll be to our own detriment, and our reputation will become one more of a fool. See? And third, you know, we can give thanks for adversities and prosperities, you see, because God is using them to accomplish something far greater than we can imagine. This is the old idea that God is working everything together for good, right? So there's, you know, see, there's no use fighting him, okay? He's not going to change his plan for your life, okay? He's not going to do that for my life just because I just want a smooth passage through this world. He's just not going to do it. There is something to the truth that nothing good comes easily. There's just something true about that saying, okay? And you're just not going to be all that you can be, okay? Unless you join the army. Unless it is tough, right? It's got to be. Because we are in a sanctification program. Romans 8 tells us to be transformed and conformed to the image of Christ, right? And that path to get there, from our weak little selves, who are always just wanting the easy way out, It takes a lot to get us conformed to that image, see? And he's just working overtime on us. Does he give us some days of prosperity in there? Yes. But the adversity that's there too, see? And it's for our own good, and we have to trust him. Okay. All right. And I'm glad we have him, because I don't know how we'd make it through our adversities without him, would we? All right? Let's close with a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the opportunity to look at some of these very interesting lessons and to really kind of think and consider, you know, the way that we think about our own lives, the way you set up our circumstances, where you have us right now, and how, you know, we've seen others, how we've seen them respond to their circumstances. We've seen ourselves. Help us to accept that both of these types of situations come from you. We're going to have a little bit of both. To know that, hey, you're at work. you're trying to craft us into something. And we just pray, Lord, that you'll help us to respond correctly. Let you craft us. We're the clay and you're the potter. Let us work along with you to accept what you're trying to craft us into. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.